From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we hear from the new director of programming for the Sundance Film Festival, which kicks off tomorrow in Park City, Utah. Then, no woman has ever won the Grammy for Producer of the Year, but Linda Perry, who has worked with singers like Dolly Parton, wants to change that.
They're not going, oh, mommy, daddy, I want to be like, you know, her. So what we need to do is establish more of the women that are producing their own stuff.
And dramatic storytelling is at the heart of the big one, KPCC's podcast about surviving a major earthquake. All that after this break. We'll start today with the Sundance Film Festival. The annual event is a big deal for those working in film and increasingly in television. There's quite a history of breakout hits that were bought by studios at the festival. Little Miss Sunshine is one example. A more recent film is The Big Sick, which earned an Oscar nomination for the screenplay written by husband and wife team Kumail Nanjiani and Emily V. Gordon. And the documentaries that debut at Sundance have increasingly found themselves award winners. Four of the five documentaries that earned Oscar nominations yesterday screened a year ago in Park City. Because the festival can launch a filmmaker's career, the stakes are really high for the people who decide what gets in. Kim Utani is head programmer for Sundance.
Somebody has watched each film in its entirety. And in many cases, it might be more than one person. The worst thing we could do as programmers is to miss a film. We want to make sure no film, great film, gets away from us.
This year, a record number of movies were submitted to Sundance, more than 14,000. 4,000 of them were feature length. Festival programmers chose 112 features representing 33 countries. More than half of the films screening in competition are directed by women, and I asked Kim Utani if that was intentional or accidental.
We, of course, want to have a festival that, first and foremost, programming films that are bold and visionary and just taking chances and telling stories in new ways. And the fact that 53% of filmmakers are women in our U.S. dramatic competition is something that happened kind of organically, I think. You know, we're always looking for gender parity in our competitions, but because these films also met these other criteria that we're looking for in films, is this wonderfully organic thing that just happened.
I've been going to Sundance for many years than I care to share, but I can say that when I first started going, independent film was just kind of coming up. It was when Tarantino and Soderbergh were starting to be important filmmakers, and then there was the whole rise of independent film with Miramax and all of that, 10 years ago. And now it seems to be an interesting point because the big studios have either closed most of their specialty film divisions or are making big tentpole movies like Harry Potter and Avengers and things like that. Do you think that the role of independent film in Hollywood has changed dramatically even in the last couple of years?
Definitely. I think that now people are looking at independent film as almost like almost giving it more importance than ever. You know, I think that a lot of the stories that we're seeing are coming out of this real genuine need to tell this story. People are feeling like they aren't being represented in the mainstream, and they're really are looking for this real outlet to tell their stories. And some of the things that we noticed this year in the program, and this is something that someone mentioned to me after the program was released, because sometimes just don't even know what we have until later when we can kind of take stock of the whole program. And somebody said, you know, there are a lot of new faces. Like I don't know a lot of the films in the competition or the filmmakers. And I think that's a very positive sign to me that we are able to be the place where people are able to discover new talent and to hear new stories and to hear what new voices are passionate about.
You and your programming staff look at hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of submissions narratives, documentaries, thousands of short films. Do you notice certain kinds of ideas or themes that filmmakers right now seem to be particularly interested in, especially in narrative films? We can talk about docs in a second, but especially in fictional narrative films. Do you start to recognize similar stories or ideas through all of those submissions?
That's a really good question, because I think because we don't program by theme, or, you know, we're not looking for anything in particular, we are coming to our TV screens or our monitors with really open minds. In terms of you know, what we discovered this year, it seems like filmmakers are focused on what is they're looking at what is truthful to them. Like, we see a lot of, and this actually goes across all of our sections, not just in fiction, that people are searching for the truth. This year in particular, I feel like there's a real stress on shedding light on the issues that we face, whether that it be in fiction or documentary.
There's obviously a way that documentary and nonfiction film can change the way that an audience looks at an issue, an idea, changes the way they think, what they do. Do you think narrative film can do the same thing? If it's not about an issue or a topic, can a narrative film change the way the audience thinks or sees the world?
I think so. You know, I think about when I first became aware of independent cinema, or when I first, the first time I went to Sundance, that was in 1995. And I saw the films Safe by Todd Haynes, Kids by Larry Clark. And those films kind of, I would say, changed my life. You know, just the idea of somebody was making films that spoke to me in this very clear way, and forced me to think in different ways and look at the world in ways I had never thought of. I think that is such a powerful thing in fiction filmmaking.
Kim Yutani is the director of programming for the Sundance Film Festival. Kim, I will see you in the snow very soon.
Thank you, John.
And tomorrow, The Frame is heading out to Park City, Utah, where we'll bring you stories and filmmakers from the Sundance Festival. Make sure you're subscribed to our podcast so you get the latest news. Coming up, we visit with Linda Perry. She has a Grammy nomination for Producer of the Year.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm your host, John Horn. No woman has ever won a Grammy for Producer of the Year, and not since 2004 has a woman even been nominated. But Linda Perry is poised to change that. Her Grammy nomination for Producer of the Year follows a busy 2018 in which she wrote and produced music with Dolly Parton for the Netflix movie Dumplin', the LA rock outfit known as Dorothy, and the up-and-coming singer-songwriter Willa Amai. Linda Perry actually got her start as lead singer of the 1990s band Four Non Blondes. You might recognize her 92 hit, What's Up? Perry went on to write and record songs for Alicia Keys, Pink, Christina Aguilera, and many more. I recently visited Perry's workspace in Studio City. It's called We Are Here. It's a label and publishing company that she co-founded with music manager Carrie Brown. Perry began with how the music industry has changed since forming Four Non Blondes.
Just being in San Francisco and joining a band, there was always these really great opportunities because we made our opportunities. You know, we didn't have internet to rely on in the 90s. We made flyers and we went out in the streets. We met people. We didn't have the opportunity of these, you know, home studios and all that. You know, we made little cassette tapes on four tracks and we had to perform. We had to go to rehearsals. We had to do all this stuff, you know. Nowadays, these kids don't have this opportunity at all. They don't know what it's like being in a rehearsal room. They just stay in a room like this, and all of a sudden they invent who they are, and that really isn't who they are.
I want to play a song from an artist you're working with, a young artist named Willa M.I. It's her cover of Daft Punk's Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger.
Work it harder, make it better, do it faster, make us stronger, more than ever, hour after. Our work is never over.
I would say a material departure from the Daft Punk version of the song. So tell me a little bit about...
You think?
A little bit. Tell me a little bit of how you met Willa and what your creative partnership is like with her.
A friend of my wife called me up and said, hey, my best friend has a daughter. She's 12 years old. And they just want to see if she's got something, you know? And I'm like, okay, for you... Of course, you're the nicest person. So I go and meet, and this total dorky kid, big bottle caps, braces for days. I mean, talking a mile a minute. And I'm like going, I loved her already. I'm like, oh my God, what a dork. I love this kid, you know? And I go, okay, what do you got? She's like, well, I wrote a song, but not really a song. It's kind of a beginning of a song, but not really because I don't have the beginning yet. But I kind of come in the middle and I have the middle of it and not really the end. So I said, so you got a middle of a song? And she's like, kind of, you know? And so she sits and plays me like this a minute song. But I could instantly tell in her voice there is something more soulful happening here. So I said, I tell you what, write 5 songs, call me in 2 months. On the clock, she calls me up and says, I've got 5 songs. So I kept my end of the deal. She came to my studio. So I'd put her up at the microphone with the piano. I said, okay, I'm just going to record this just for my own self so I can just hear it. So she does that, didn't make one mistake. Plays all 6 songs, and I'm in tears, okay? And I come out, and then I decided right there, I'm going to mentor her. I never mind you, I just have to say this, I never touched her songs. All I did was tell her to change keys, because she would tend to write lower. And I'm like, raise that key, and then tempo. I would speed songs up or slow them down. That was all I did.
How much of your work with somebody like that or any artist is grounded by your own experience as a musician? Having played in a band and having worked on stage, does that change the way you see the relationship between a performer and a producer? And does it benefit the artist in some ways because you understand what he or she is going through?
For me, all I know is my job as a producer and with anybody that I work with is to create a safe environment, but an honest one. Like, so when you come to me, it's like everything's from scratch. I sit, we talk, and then while you're talking, I start feeling something, and I'll pick up the guitar or go to the piano, and I'm like, it's time, and they'll go, time for what? I'm like, a song is coming, you know, and then we'll start creating a song. So it's very important for me to put your clothes on, not you put mine on. So that part is really, really what was really important with Willa, because I didn't want to be Linda Perry, this, you know, old producer that comes in and tells this little kid that has a fresher perspective than I do at this point, you know. So my job was to just help her and nurture her.
We're talking with Linda Perry, who is nominated for Producer of the Year at the Grammys. So I'm going to ask you about the opposite side of that equation. When you're working with people who are not quite as young as Willa, you've worked with people like Pat Benatar, Pink, Gwen Stefani. I want to play the song Halfway Gone. It's a song you wrote for Pink.
It's sad that I can't be there, because I know that you're sinking. If only I could be there, and if you think you're happy.
The Serve Like a Girl soundtrack. Those were all demos that were done in one day. So like that song by Pink, it was never released. So all these songs were demos that were written that day and recorded that day. So that's just to me, very, very cool. And when when this Serve Like a Girl came to my attention, it was so touching to me, this whole story about these women that are coming back from doing their term and coming back to absolutely no support from the government whatsoever. The women actually had to go to get welfare. That's what the movie is about. 100% of all the funds. I asked all the artists, hey, I'm working on this documentary. Do you mind if I use this unreleased song? They were like, yeah.
One of the things that was remarkable to me is you worked with Dolly Parton on Dumplin'. And I think I read that she had never had a woman producer before.
Yep.
That's unbelievable. I mean, but I guess when only 3% of producers are women, statistically, it fits.
Right.
Why is that? Why has it been so hard for women to get even a toehold of producing jobs?
I think there's a lot of women producers. They're just producing their own stuff. There's not a lot of women engineers. And that, to me, is far more important than being a producer. You know, anybody can jot their name on production and go, I'm the producer of this. And we know tons of those people. To me, the power position is the engineer. That person's actually the person that's really actually doing all the creative stuff and getting cool sounds and creating a beautiful sonic bed for people to perform their songs on. And that position is just not sexy. You know what I mean? So they're not going, oh, mommy, daddy, I want to be like, you know, her. So what we need to do is establish more of the women that are doing more of the technical side. And there are, there's Grimes, but she works in the box. You know, we have an artist named Angel Hayes that produced her album. She was in the box, but then she took it out of the box to put real horns, strings, did all her vocals in the studio, but created the bulk of the foundation of the album in the box. So there's producers or engineers that engineer in Pro Tools. And then there's engineers like me. I move microphones around. I know how to mic a drum set. We don't come from that world right now. We're getting samples. And, you know, I just did an album for this artist of mine named Dorothy. You said you loved me, but you threw me out in the garbage. That album was live. Like, we rehearsed it, wrote it in a rehearsal room, did all the pre-production, and then went into the studio and just recorded it. And it sounds great. And people heard, I'm up for a Grammy Producer of the Year because of that album. So it's like, I'm working on getting you an answer, but I'm hoping that we won't have to answer it anymore because I'm working on being proactive and just doing. We are now.
What can you do inside the Academy, because you're now a governor with the Recording Academy, from inside to change not only, you know, engineers, producers, to make sure that there is much more equality and equity in the years ahead than there is now?
I'm so excited to be of service, you know, for them, because they do a lot. The Recording Academy does a lot. We just don't know about it, but they are advocating on so many levels, you know, fighting for songwriters, musicians. And so right now I'd started this, I'm calling it We Are Now. Like, I just shot one. It's me in the studio with Alicia Keys, Angel Hayes, and we're just talking about our favorite drum technique, how Alicia got that synth part. You know, we're talking to Angel Hayes about how she went from being in the box to recording, you know, horns, you know, for the album. So it's not talking about we're women at all. You can see we're women. It's talking about what we like to do. So I just edited it. It's really, really cool.
Where is it available? Where can
people
see it?
Well, that's what I'm working on. So I have a deal right now with YouTube that we might release it on YouTube and make it a series. I have one set up for with Sheryl Crow, Grimes, and Dolly that we're going to shoot in Nashville in a few weeks. So, you know, I'm trying to be proactive. So I'm on it. I'm on it.
Linda, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up, storytelling is at the heart of everything that comes out of Hollywood, and now it's a key element of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One.
Popcorn soda, box of Raisinets, velvet cushioned seats and soft armrests, best seat in my favorite movie house.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Hollywood is famous for using all the devices of cinematic storytelling, realistic production design, a well-placed swell of music, and always at its core, a character-driven narrative to bring you into the story. Today, podcasting has exploded with similar creative approaches, and one of the newest arrivals to the story-driven podcast scene is a KPCC original called The Big One, Your Survival Guide. The podcast about surviving a major earthquake is made to draw listeners into the story using storytelling and sound design, all while leaving the audience with potentially life-saving information. Arwen Champion Nix is head of KPCC On Demand and the executive producer of The Big One. Jacob Margolis is KPCC's science reporter and the host of the podcast. When I spoke with the two of them, Jacob began by explaining exactly what they mean by The Big One.
So the big one that we're talking about in this podcast is a 7.8 magnitude earthquake on the southern San Andreas Fault. Let's compare it to Northridge for a second, which was a 6.7. That only impacted a small portion of LA. This 7.8 magnitude quake will impact the majority of Southern California. So San Bernardino, Los Angeles, Riverside counties, all those areas, Orange County as well.
The way you tell this story, Arwen, is pretty novel. You kind of make up a story, and you have at its center the guy sitting to your left, which is Jacob, and about what he's going through. But it's essentially a fictional story that you're creating in the aftermath of this horrific earthquake. Why did you decide that that was an effective way to tell the story?
All the science says this will happen. But like you said, it hasn't happened yet. So we wanted to orient all the listeners, give them someone to relate to. And we thought, why not make the listener the hero of the show? This is going to be about people preparing, about what they're going to see, what infrastructure will fail.
You make your way outside of Union Station. The air is thick with dust. Stoplights are out, traffic is jammed, and it's loud. The people who ran when the earthquake hit are laying on the ground, injured, and they're holding their broken legs and twisted ankles. An aftershock hits.
So we wanted to put people in the heart of that scenario and show them what it's going to be like so they know what to prepare for.
So even if people know on some level that this event could happen in the immediate future,
yes,
but certainly in their lifetimes, they don't do enough to prepare for it. So what prevents people from not taking the next step and saying, I need to do these five things before this happens?
We have this thing called optimism, right? And we actually have a whole episode, episode 8, we cover this at length. We developed optimism at the same time as we developed a sense of mortality. That way we get into cars, even though we know that situation could be dangerous. But that same optimism is what keeps us from preparing.
So I don't want to be a spoiler, but in the second episode, it comes out, Jacob, that you have very limited, if any, earthquake preparedness at your own home. Is that a fair statement?
Not anymore.
Okay. But at the time you're doing this.
At the time I was doing it, yes.
Okay.
When we were recording episode 2, that was absolutely true. My wife and I had a very come-to-Jesus moment about what our plan was. We have a new baby, so we have to kind of factor that in. By episode 7, which is when we start to address this issue and me building a survival kit for my family, I still hadn't done anything. Which was kind of crazy. And we get to dive deep into the psychology of why people don't do it. That was really fascinating. And applying it to myself, I thought, was kind of disturbing.
In 1992, there was a 7.3 magnitude earthquake out near Yucca Valley called the Landers Quake. And I drove out there because I was assigned to cover the news. There was one immediate fatality from that earthquake. It was a 3-year-old boy who was over for a slumber party, and some masonry fell off a chimney and fell on his head. And because I was a reporter, I went to the coroner's office and I saw the Polaroid photograph of the sleeping bag and the bricks and the blood. Mm. And I didn't have kids at that point, but when I had kids, I did everything. Everything in our house is anchored down. And it was that one image that I always remembered. Is that part of what you're going after, that idea, if you put yourself in the story and visualize it, that you then start to do something?
Yeah, we want something people can hold onto. I want you to really put yourself in the situation where imagine you have to walk 15 miles, a really common commute in Los Angeles. Imagine having to walk that home and what you're going to see. So we want to put you in that situation to prepare you so when these things do happen, you're a little bit more familiar and maybe a little bit less afraid.
That was very similar to my turning point. And it wasn't that gruesome and that difficult. But we had someone visit our house and lay out, here are all the problems that I see. Your kid, by the way, is just getting up and starting to walk. And we just yanked his dresser a little bit. That thing was ready to topple right over. And I could just imagine him getting very hurt by that. And I was freaked out. And so soon thereafter, we kind of went through and dealt with all that.
You have clearly worked very hard to make sure that the listener is kind of embedded in this story through a lot of the things that you do, both musically and just the way that the sound is coming at you. Why was that important, and what does that do in terms of the way the information that you're imparting to the listener is received?
One, I love sound design and I love action movies. So I wanted to create this immersive experience, and sound is so powerful in doing that. It's one thing to say an ambulance is going to pass you by. It's another thing to hear it happening. It's another thing to hear masonry crumbling and to have the vibration in your stomach. But the other thing that was really important to me was to differentiate between when you are hearing an expert or someone who has lived through a disaster and when you are hearing a fictional part of it. So the fictional part is very heavily sound designed to indicate, hey, this is the fiction. This is what hasn't happened. And then we strip that away and just use music when we're interviewing people who have lived through some really intense stuff.
Arwen Champion Nix is the head of podcast at KPCC and the executive producer of The Big One. Jacob Margolis is KPCC's science reporter and the host of the podcast. Arwen and Jacob, thanks for coming downstairs.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Episode number 3 of The Big One is out tomorrow. You can get the podcast from your favorite sources, including Apple and Stitcher. That's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We're back here tomorrow.